AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, March 27th, 2011, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. There's probably no company or institution that has emerged in the last decade that has risen to prominence to such a dramatic extent as Google. Googleization of everything is the topic of today's show. We're going to have as our guest an internet scholar and media scholar who's written a new book on this subject, the Googleization of everything, and why we should worry about it. It should be an exceptional hour. I hope you can join us. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
AT&T has made a surprising deal to acquire T-Mobile for $39 billion. AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson brushed off notions of creating a duopoly, saying the industry will continue to be a fiercely competitive market. But many analysts say the combination of the second and fourth largest wireless providers in the United States would further consolidate a market already ravaged by mergers. And consolidation is usually bad news for consumers. Matt Wood is Associate Director of Media Access Project, a nonprofit public interest law firm.
We've kind of seen a relatively steady slide towards fewer and fewer competitors over the last decade. You look at these annual reports that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, does about the state of competition in the wireless market. And they used to be able to say there are at least seven nationwide competitors, and then it's six, and then it's five. You know, people like when Sprint acquired Nextel, and that took out a whole competitor.
If AT&T devours T-Mobile, we'll be down to three national competitors, AT&T, Verizon, and Sprint. AT&T and Verizon will control 80% of the wireless market. Is that market competitive enough to keep prices low and service choices abundant? Wood says no.
There is some competition in some markets, but they are able to look at each other and not really compete on price terms, not really compete on service conditions and on things like early termination fees or text message pricing or any number of other places in which they take a little bit more out of your pocket.
Because T-Mobile doesn't have access to the iPhone or other popular devices, it uses creative pricing to attract customers and keep market prices from skyrocketing.
The loss of that sort of competitive pricing carrier, that will be a big loss, and that will take away what we see as a natural restriction on AT&T and Verizon's ability to jack their prices up.
AT&T Stephenson also touted the deal for creating efficiencies that will save money as the two companies share assets.
Efficiencies are often talked about in merger proposals to shareholders, and what efficiencies mean to us is job losses and cutting back on the investment and on the workforce that these companies need to employ in order to provide service. So, you know, this is not a job creator.
For more information, go to mediaaccess.org.
Community media projects faring with the digital transition? Are community media centers using open source technologies to produce local news and entertainment? How can local collaborations create a vibrant community media center? These questions will all be addressed during a panel discussion at the National Conference for Media Reform in Boston, April 8th through 10th. The conference is bringing together thousands of people who want to change our media system. More community media is high on the list. This panel will feature the pioneering work of community media projects that are responding to the challenge of the digital transition. Panelist Martha Fuentes-Bautista is Assistant Professor of Communication and Public Policy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Right now we are working on how to bring community into the media. And I think that this is the future of media localism and diversity.
Hundreds of other speakers will address a wide range of issues, from the intersections of social justice and the media to protecting free speech online. Fuentes-Bautista says the conference has a dramatic impact on the movement to create better media.
I think I have attended every National Conference of Media Reform since 2003, and every time I have participated in one of them, I see the discussion on these issues advancing, and we have found really new grounds to rethink media policy.
As Fuentes-Bautista prepares for her own panel, she said she's also gearing up for the energy the conference builds.
What fascinates me about this conference is that actually bringing together activists, media makers, academics, policymakers in a way that is unique. Let's see how much we can do.
The National Conference for Media Reform is April 8th through 10th at the Boston Seaport. To check out Fuentes-Bautista's panel, the entire program, and register for the event, visit freepress.net.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Our guest today is a very prominent cultural historian and media scholar, is currently a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. His name is Siva Vaidyanathan, and he is the author of a new book, The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry, just published by the University of California Press. Siva Vaidyanathan, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. It's really good to be here.
Well, you've written many books, and I suspect our listeners are familiar with you, though they don't know how to pronounce your last name. I think you've got the one last name probably gets more mangled than my own by people. And this book was a real pleasure to read. And I just, you know, before we get into it, Siva, tell us, you know, what was your motivation for writing this book? What was the origin of it, the genesis?
So, yeah, about in 2004, you know, a lifetime ago, an internet time, I was thinking about a few things. One of which was the then recently announced plan by Google to scan in millions of books from libraries around the world, and this struck me as simultaneously struck me as exciting, like it did for so many people, like an amazing thing we would have. So much better access to so many books, but at the same time, I thought, "What the heck? This company is 6 years old, and the University of Michigan was in a position where it thought that Google would be the appropriate custodian for, its hundreds of years of and millions of dollars worth of investment of public money in all of this amazing knowledge." And I thought, companies do some amazing things and make our lives better in some very important ways, but one thing we know about them is they don't last, right? And so I kept thinking, well, why would the six-year-old company be in a better position than all of these major institutions at the time, Harvard, Stanford, New York Public Library, Oxford, University of Michigan, to coordinate this effort and do it right? And so that started me on a number of different questions. And because I had done earlier research on copyright, there were so many interesting copyright questions raised by that plan. And so I kind of geeked out on it, but I also was really interested in the future of libraries, in the future of knowledge, in the future of the academy, and all of those questions sort of melded in this. You know, what should our relationship be with these really impressive, powerful companies? And then I started looking more into Google and realized Google is special. Google is, while it's just another company, and I kept that in mind throughout it all, Google has outsized ambitions. And when I started poking around and I saw that the mission statement of this company, even at that in those early days, was to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible, I said, who the heck asked you guys, right, to do that? You know, like, that's, you know, even institutions like Harvard and Oxford don't assume that that is their mission. You know, they have much more, if you can believe it, modest ambitions for their role in society. And I thought, well, you know, what a weird age we're living in when we don't blink an eye at a publicly traded corporation declaring that as its mission, that we don't question deep in our gut the notion that a publicly traded corporation will come in and, like an angel, do things for us. You know, I thought, what a weird moment in human history when most of us just fold this company into our daily routines without asking questions about its motivations, its background, its biases. And so I thought this is a hugely fertile area for investigation. But I also thought, you know, it's also fascinating because Google actually doesn't, you know, kill babies or anything. It's, you know, if I decided to write about tobacco companies or something, you know, and have a lot of stuff to mess around with in real, you know, real horrible stories about harm in the world, and you can't really catalog the people Google has hurt, right? It's not a long list, but that, I think, made it more interesting. I think just like in your work, the notion that we take these shiny, friendly, happy things in our lives and we start interrogating and pushing at this stuff with some hard questions often yields controversial but really interesting results in conversations. And so, you know, I thought I would start a few arguments, and I think I have.
I think you have too, Siva. And in the book, you know, let's just start at the beginning here with Google, you know, because it did rise really out of nowhere almost a decade ago, a little over a decade ago, and come to rule the roost of the digital universe. What was the basis for its success? What distinguished it from the pack?
Well, I like to remind people that, you know, often the foundation myths of companies are just that, right? So while you know, Google appeared in our lives without ever buying a Super Bowl ad until very recently, and without, you know, really having to campaign for our affection, you know, we all sort of got to know it and got into it because some friend we trusted said, way back in 2000 or so, you know, there's a better search engine and it's called Google and it goes faster and it gives you better results, et cetera. And just by feeling through it, we, you know, millions of people started using Google every day. But the foundation myth is important, you know, in the sense that Silicon Valley always wants you to believe that it was, you know, the lone genius in the garage, or maybe in this case, two geniuses in a garage, coming up with a brilliant insight and then getting, you know, swashbuckling venture capitalists to put forth millions and then leveraging that into a business that didn't seem it could make money and then later made money, right? That's the standard story. But let's not forget that this never would have happened if not for the National Science Foundation funding the research of Sergey Brin and Larry Page as graduate students at Stanford University, a heavily subsidized institution that depends on all sorts of money, science funding, military funding, humanities funding, all going into these projects. So, you know, just like the infrastructure of the Internet itself came out of a publicly minded and publicly funded project, the greatest Internet entrepreneurial success story of our age owes itself to a sense of public responsibility, public funding, and a commitment that this government once had that you can actually invest in science for the public good.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Siva Vaidyanathan, who's the author of the brand new book, The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry, just published with considerable acclaim by the University of California Press. He's joining us live today on Media Matters, so the phone lines are open if you'd like to call in with a question or comment. The phone number here, 217-333-9455, or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Siva, as you said at the top, Google is not a company that produces toxic chemicals or kills people or creates wars. And to the normal person who Googles things, like probably every listener to this show does, and as I do and you do, that Google has so worked into the fabric of our lives, you know, we don't pay them anything. What's not to love? This group provides a spectacular service. It lets us surf the web. It gives us email, makes access to YouTube and countless other things we'll talk about during the course of the show. You know, what's not to love here? And then secondly, what's in it for Google? Why are they doing all these wonderful things for us without charging us?
Yeah, I tend not to try to love any inanimate object or or phenomenon in the world, right? I mean, okay, I'll admit I love my country, I love my family, I love my dog, I love, you know, several hundred other people for wonderful reasons, but
the Buffalo Bills.
Yeah, but you know, I don't love a company, I don't love my car, I don't even love my house. But what's fascinating to me about the way people talk about Google is it often sounds like love. It doesn't sound like eros. It sounds like agape, right? It sounds like people are when you read how people talk about Google, especially in the early days, and what Google means in their lives, there is the sense that we get this gift of grace from this company that is mysterious. It's beyond mysterious, right? It's omnipresent and omnipotent and omniscient and benevolent, right? So, in so many ways, what struck me about Google from the early days of looking at it was how much religious language emanates from the founders and from its apostles who are out, you know, writing wonderful things about how every company should be like Google, and so that struck me as I'm not a religious person, but it struck me as frankly blasphemous and to a large degree foolish. That said, like you said, you and I both use Google every day. I have tremendous respect for the people who work at Google, for the skill that they exhibit when they build the systems that they build, the insight and brilliance that put them in a situation to be able to reap tremendous rewards, again, without doing much harm in the world. They've remade the advertising world and really shook it up in ways that I think we can all sort of, you know, enjoy watching after years of wondering when people are going to wake up to the fact that advertising was a bit of a scam overall. You know, we now look at this and say, well, look, you know, when firms get a chance to actually get a measure of their effectiveness of ads, it turns out that the old Procter & Gamble strategy of advertising didn't make all that much sense.
You know,
those reasons, we can really appreciate what Google's done and use it, but let's use it wiser and let's use it in a way that understands and deals with the fact that Google is a company that has interests that are pretty clear and explanatory. I mean, you know, it has to provide a return for its investment, for its investors. There's nothing wrong with that. But let's not imagine it's some mystical force in the universe.
Well, on that point, advertising is the key basis of revenues for Google. I mean, I think that's where the lion's share of its income comes from at this point. And you said it's revolutionizing advertising. It seems that is there going to be a place in Google's universe for the sort of advertising that dominates traditional media, the sort of beer ads and Coca-Cola ads, or not to pick on a particular brand, but cola drink, soft drink ads, all sort of beauty products. You know, these ads that basically have very little to do with the actual quality of the product or the price, of just a lot of imagery. Can Google accommodate the needs of companies like cola companies and beer companies to do what's largely vacant image advertising?
Well, you know, that's interesting because the vacant image advertising, right, that's what makes sense when you think about buying an ad on football on Sunday, you know, on Fox. You know, that's where you would expect to see the pickup truck, the beer ad, the soft drink ad, the snack chip ad, for that very reason that you point out. These are undifferentiated and undifferentiable goods in the world where the brand and the imagery is half of the value. It's not like there's any nutritional value to those snack chips. So the answer is actually Google has not had to master that area because there is so much money to be made from smaller companies and more specific targeted marketing efforts. The sad fact is enough Americans drink beer and eat snack chips that it justifies the money that those companies spend on a Sunday on Fox. Whether that sort of mass marketing will continue to work and justify itself on CBS Evening News is another question, right? Because there's a more targeted market. There's a market that, you know, the vast majority of people watch it are over 40. The vast majority of people who watch it are reducing in number steadily. It's you know, for those areas, you can see Google being able to muscle in on more targeted ads. Because the key is Google seems to read your mind. And it seems to read your mind because it knows all of the things you've told Google over the years It also, Google also knows where you're sitting, what other sorts of people live around you, where you might want to shop. And so when you do a search for a term or a phrase, the ads that run along the right side are likely to reflect the combination of factors that you've expressed to Google. And the ads are going to be highly targeted to where you live, to the sorts of things you're interested in.
Yeah, see, let me rephrase the question. This question is not quite in your book, but it's you're one of the few people I know who might be able to answer it.
Okay.
So I think it's really a central question for the future of advertising on the internet, which is the lion's share of national advertising, where the hundreds of the billions of dollars go to television primarily, but also to a lesser extent to radio and to a lesser extent the internet, but still disproportionately to television. Are for products like beers and soft drinks and insurance and all sorts of beauty products, and the list goes on and on, where there really isn't a great deal of difference between the products. There isn't really a tangible price or qualitative difference. A lot of it is this sort of imagery stuff.
Right.
And for that reason, the internet advertising is still well below its proportion of the actual amount of attention and time people spend on the internet. It gets much less a percentage of advertising than does television. Is there any way Google will be able to accommodate the huge accounts of Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, beer companies, and all sorts of other Procter & Gamble products, where there's really very little to talk about the product in terms of price that will distinguish it from its two or three competitors?
Well, I think that there's no reason it couldn't for those reasons. The real challenge here is if you've expressed yourself as a certain sort of person, maybe Google senses you're under 25 and is more likely to pitch you a Pepsi ad than a Coke ad. I mean, those sorts of things can happen. The real key here is that steadily, I think we're seeing in the advertising world, the firms that are spending the money on advertising are asking, if I'm going to spend a dollar on AM radio or a dollar on Google, you know, an AM radio local show or on Google, where am I getting a better return? And right now, the big companies with the big ad budgets have not had to ask that question. If they start demanding better accountability, they may find that the Google system or the Facebook system, which is very similar, will accommodate them better. I don't think we know the answer to your question. But I don't think there's any reason that Google couldn't demonstrate to those big companies with the big budgets that they can give better results for the few dollars invested. And, you know, Google makes a lot of its money a nickel at a time anyway. It doesn't care about the big bang budgets. They don't rely on those sorts of...
But that's the big game in the jungle if they're going to make the next leap, isn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, they'll take it if it comes. I mean, Google's making so much money right now, they don't have to hustle for it. But, you know, so I don't think they have to alter their business to be able to get this. Now, they just recently, last year, they bought DoubleClick, which, you know, installs a lot of the banner ads you see on a variety of pages. So they are opening themselves up to different forms of advertising, and they're essentially cornering the market on web advertising, the open web advertising, as much as anybody can. I think we're going to see some of those big companies try to figure out ways. I mean, I spend a lot of time on Facebook, and I already see a lot of these bigger companies, Toyota, for instance, buying ads on Facebook in ways that are trying to, you know, target particular, smaller segments of the Facebook audience. So, I can see a lot of those companies starting to play around with both the Google and the Facebook model of targeting, and perhaps seeing that it's not as much of a waste of money as buying those big ads on Sunday, and that could really shake a lot of the status quo in American media.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Siva Vaidyanathan. Siva is a professor at the University of Virginia, a noted media scholar and cultural critic who's written numerous books. This new book, The Googleization of Everything, just published by the University of California Press. That's what we're talking about this hour on WILL. The phone lines are open at 333-9455. Our toll-free line open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. I think you're to be commended for pointing out that Google is a corporation, and we might be skeptical about what they do as a corporation. I was wondering, could you comment on the fact that as a corporation, its goal, of course, is to make money, and how that has affected the recent overturn of the Google Book settlement?
Sure, yeah.
The question
probably
is,
talk too much
did
about
anybody
that.
Really
have to cut
attend
me off,
to the
Bob.
Fact?
Okay.
Well, before you get into that, let me just say, because that's a great question. It was one of the things I was about to turn to. The new decision just came down, and you write a lot about this in the book. And for listeners who might not be familiar with the whole background, could you just give a couple-minute background on the Google Book project?
So, and rolling in reverse, so on Tuesday, this last Tuesday, a federal judge in New York ruled that a settlement between copyright holders and Google over a copyright lawsuit dealing with the fact that Google was scanning in all these copyrighted books from the 20th century was rejected. So the judge rejected this settlement agreement. 2 years ago, the parties, after bickering for years and years about this lawsuit, agreed to a really creative settlement. I'll describe that in a second. But this really all comes back to 2004, 2005, when Google announced it was going to scan in all this stuff, and all these copyright holders said, this is clearly copyright infringement, and then each side began mounting their various arguments and strategies. Now, what this settlement rejection does is basically throw everything back into court, into the original question of, is what Google did okay under American copyright or not? And that could take a whole other show. What we found out after all of this, when Google first started the project, Google was making claims that it was essentially trying to back up the libraries of the world, create a system that would sort of open up all of this knowledge to people. It spoke in egalitarian terms. People talked about it, and Google talked about itself as if it were doing library-type work. And this was all going to be for the public good, and it was all going to, expand our knowledge and all this good stuff. And then by the time they reached a settlement with the publishers, it became clear that they had thrown that public service notion completely out. And what they were actually building, according to the settlement, was a huge used bookstore where they were getting insulated from liability for scanning in all this stuff by the settlement. And in exchange, Google would sell electronic copies of all of these books and split the revenue with the copyright holder, splitting the revenue based on prices that Google only and Google itself would determine with no competition. So it was a huge antitrust problem, huge competition problem. But fundamentally, what we learned was that Google was interested in being a bookstore and not actually interested in being a library, which shouldn't have surprised anybody, but it actually did break a lot of hearts. There were a lot of people, a lot of different reasons for opposing the settlement. The judge, read all kinds of really persuasive arguments against accepting the settlement. Some of them were technically legal, and some of them were based on big issues about copyright and competition and antitrust and so forth. And ultimately, the judge said, we can't have this. Oh, you can't have a class action lawsuit settlement determine major issues in American copyright and information policy. And in fact, if you want to change policy at this level, you better go to Congress, which is really the right answer. And I don't think I've read anyone who has made a persuasive case to the contrary on that. Now, a lot of people will disagree about whether what Google wants to do in terms of copyright in the first place is warranted or not. So one of the things is, I think a lot of us got floored, a lot of us got snowed back in 2004, 2005 by the excitement of Google opening up all these libraries, right? And this really, I think, was the root of my confusion, because a lot of the people who had been with me in the copyright battles of the early aughts, right, the early part of the 21st century, really thought that here is a big rich company finally coming to the rescue of a more a sort of bolder and more open vision of copyright. And that, while that was true, I just think that they were going about it the wrong way. You can't just ask a federal court to completely overturn American copyright. There was no way that the political system in this country was going to let that happen anyway. I thought that Google's arguments, copyright arguments, were fairly weak, but I wasn't very popular on my side of the copyright battles with that statement. People really want to believe that fair use is stronger than it really is, and I kept saying it's really not, and we should want it to be, but we can't just wish it that way.
Can I ask you, are we going to get this Google library then some way, somewhere? Are we going to have all the books of the world digitized and accessible through an easy search online? Is that in the cards by Google or anyone else?
Sure, as long as we are A, political, and B, patient and C, realistic, right? So, and whether that all happens is a big question. But so what we have, you know, Google will continue to scan these things in and will try to figure out a way to do what it wanted to do. And I'm not confident that it actually ever will. But in the meantime, we have some really neat initiatives. A number of the Big Ten schools, including your employer, the University of Illinois, is involved in what's known as HathiTrust. They've been taking the Google scans of all these books that have been coming back to the universities and creating a university-run archive that that university communities can access and search through so that Google doesn't control access to this stuff. And that's a really healthy move. It corrects for a lot of the problems that Google was creating. It has some other flaws in there, but and then there are other initiatives. Brewster Kahle, who's this amazing internet entrepreneur who has become a philanthropist, started the Open Book Alliance a number of years ago, an effort to create a very high quality version of what Google was doing. But of course, it doesn't have the lawyers or the gumption to scan in copyrighted works, so it's mostly public domain works. But that's an amazing collection as well. The Open Book Alliance, it's done in partnerships with dozens of universities around the country as well. And now Robert Darnton, who's been running Harvard's library for the last few years, has launched a campaign for the Digital Library of America, which has this explicitly public mission to not let companies like Google privatize our heritage and our knowledge. And he's done a series of articles in the New York Review of Books and just this last week in the New York Times pushing for this notion that tracks very well with an idea that I've been pushing, which I call the Human Knowledge Project. My vision is sort of global and 50 years down the line. Bob's idea is much more national and maybe 10 years down the line. They both require some serious attention paid to getting copyright right, you know, because basically no one could do it, Google or anyone else, unless we can convince Congress that having such a library system is worth doing. And changing copyright is necessary to do it. That means going up against Disney, up against News Corporation in all those horrible ways. It means that the chances of succeeding are of course slim, but you know it's really a measure of how much we want it and how much we want to fight for it. Basically, you know, as I wrote this book and as I thought through all these issues in the world, I kept coming to the conclusion that you have to be political if you want anything worthwhile to happen from this. You can't just wait for the magic company in the clouds to do it. So yes, I think it can happen, but it really is only as feasible as it is desirable, and it's up to people like me and people like Bob Darnton to go around and campaign for it and get the brightest people, most hardworking young people to get involved in an effort with a clear agenda to change copyright, to raise the money, to get institutions lined up towards such a goal. Because my goal, and it's not exactly Bob Darnton's goal, my goal is to have every 12-year-old growing up in South Africa in 50 years be able to access the same quality and same quantity of information as a 12-year-old growing up in Sweden or Canada. I think we have the technology to actually, for once in human history, solve that problem. What we don't have is the political will, and we have too much on the other side of the balance preventing that sort of dream from coming true. So if you don't address it politically, you're just wasting your time.
Siva Vaidyanathan is our guest today in Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, the host. Siva is the author of the brand new book, The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry, just published by University of California Press. Siva, in the book, you talk about privacy, which is sort of the beneath the surface part of the iceberg of the Google business model, as far as I can tell. And it's starting to get a little bit of attention with regard to the cell phone companies that just came out recently, how the cell phone companies have the ability to track everywhere you go. It's come out now with Facebook and its business model and how much they know about you. And Google, too, its business model to no small extent is built on basically knowing as much as they possibly can about us from the information they collect about each of us. Is this a problem, or is this just the price of being free in the 21st century?
Wow, yeah, well, it depends on what you mean by free, of course, as everything does. So it is a problem in ways that we can't necessarily always predict. But I would say that in general, I think we should try to agree that people should be informed as to the greatest extent possible of their personal information and their behaviors being tracked by companies and governments, right? That there should be some level of transparency there, and there should be some level of informed consent. Those are pretty strong and well-established principles in medicine. Those are strong and well-established principles in education. Until the Bush administration, it was a strong and well-established principle in terms of dealing with the government, too. But when it comes to companies, we've sort of let it all slip. We have let this amazing industry, and it's really been 40 years. For 40 years, the industry of direct marketing has been able to track us and our movements and our credit card usage and now our cell phone usage in ways that can really precisely profile us. We keep thinking, no harm, no foul. But in fact, occasionally there is a harm, right? So you can imagine, and there actually have been examples of federal law enforcement officials tapping into databases, commercial databases that track behavior to try to identify patterns of people who might be troublemakers. We know of at least a couple of cases in which people have been falsely profiled as dangerous people, simply because they left the wrong traces in the wrong places, and they have to deal with at least some measure of harassment, if not something worse. So that's one danger. The other danger is basically there's insecurity in the system. Bad people could find out about our personal information. Organized crime can unleash tremendous collections of data and figure out how to steal our identities and use our credit cards and so forth. There are lots of real-life examples of dangers that go beyond the ickiness that I think and the creepiness that generally comes up in discussions of privacy. But Google and Facebook, I think, are the two most obvious players in terms of this discussion. But every supermarket chain in America and Barnes & Noble and Amazon, they're all involved in this sort of identity targeting. And let's not forget the two major political parties in this country do a lot of it as well, too.
But if I can interject, it does seem, though, from reading your book, Siva, that violating traditional notions of privacy and collecting extraordinary amounts of information is really hardwired into the business model of Google and Facebook, that it isn't hardwired into the business model of McDonald's hamburgers or some other company. I mean, if they don't have the ability to learn as much as they possibly can about us beneath the surface from what we do online and our profile us, then they can't sell us. They can't sell us to advertisers very effectively.
Exactly. So you're absolutely right about that. And that is an important distinction. I do think it's important, though, that we remember that this problem goes to marketing and advertising in general, right? And so all of those other companies, Barnes & Noble, McDonald's, Safeway, they're all embedded in this system. But in terms of, the centrality of it, Facebook and Google are the best examples of this sort of, targeting of products and services and advertising to us based on this. So, if we had some basic safeguards that I think would be healthy, like, for instance, Google wants to be able to not only pitch ads to us very precisely, but pitch search results to us very precisely. And by default, we are treated to its full-on data vacuuming and profiling services. If we care, if we think about this issue, worry about it, would like to get different results, we are invited, not really invited, but if you find out about it, you can walk your way through the About Google pages and adjust your settings. But who knows to do that?
Oh, yeah. That's just going to be like some computer whiz to do that. Most people just want to get their stuff.
Yeah. It's not technically complicated, but the problem is, of course, first you have to know that they're doing it, and then you have to know that it's a problem, and then you have to know how to fix it, right? So three steps that basically my father is not.
Hey, I couldn't do it. I'll be honest with you. I'm step one, and I'm already saying, "What the heck is this?" And I'm bailing out and going to the ESPN homepage or something.
Right. And so this is how they trick you with freedom, right, and choice, right? Because Google will say it's no problem; anyone can opt out.
Yeah, right.
It's absolutely true that anyone can opt out. That doesn't mean realistically it's going to happen, or that the number of people who should opt out will even realize it's a problem. So Google Street View is a great example here. In this country, when Google started sending cars around to all of our streets and taking pictures of our houses and taking pictures of our pets and people walking in the street and people walking in and out of gambling establishments and pornography establishments. Like, nobody complained, really. There was like one lawsuit I know about, and I've never found a record of another lawsuit in the U.S. Very few public complaints. Very few people really even saying, hey, this is creepy. We just sort of went along with it. And that we have a very particular and, I think, peculiar strong demarcation between public and private in the United States. In the rest of the world, there was uproar about this practice, the very same practice. And even in Canada, there was uproar about it, right? And in Europe, to this day, we see lots of people mounting public campaigns against Google Street View. We see the, you know, each of these countries has an official privacy officer, something we could never get away with in this country, who've been working with Google and investigating the practices and so forth. They discovered that Google had in fact been monitoring the Wi-Fi traffic of people's houses as their cars drove by, and collecting data from, you know, that we reflected what people were doing on their computers in their houses. And Google said, it was just a mistake, just a glitch. In the meantime, in England, there were actual street protests. Like, people flooded out in front of Google cars to stop them from taking pictures. People keep sending me images of people signaling the Google cars with a variety of, you know, very creative and standard finger and hand gestures that one would see in the United Kingdom, expressing their displeasure with Google. You know, and of course in England you see hundreds of photos of people vomiting outside of pubs and, you know, all sorts of other obnoxious behavior. And so, you know, basically what's happening there is, you can imagine, in Germany there is a history, a very recent history, of people being threatened by parties watching them, not always the state. Sometimes it was a neighbor, sometimes it was the grocer down the street keeping tabs on them. And there is, I think, a legitimate sense that we should feel confident that we are not being tracked. And we don't have that historical awareness in this country for a variety of reasons.
And there's tremendous commercial pressure for us not to have that protection currently, so it's really not happening, is it?
Exactly, right? And you know, one of the things that's been really fascinating to me is in England, and I don't have an explanation for this, but people reacted so viscerally to Google doing this level of still photograph surveillance that doesn't even have a live moment capture, and yet way too much toleration for the state doing the same thing in England, which I've never been able to figure out that discrepancy. But it is one of the more interesting things. But in Greece and Germany, in Italy and France, there have been a number of really strong challenges to Google Street View in ways that we don't have here. In Japan, a lot of people protested the fact that, you know, in the older areas of the cities, the houses are so close to the street and so close together that with the camera mounted 6 feet above the car, Google was taking images straight into people's houses. And there's a sense that, you know, when you're walking in these areas of Tokyo, there's a social norm that you avert your gaze because you can't help. If you turn your head, you're in someone's living room, you know. And so people have understood for many years that it is impolite and improper to look into someone's house. And here was Google coming along, not only looking into someone's house, but letting the rest of us do it. And it took Google a while to realize just how much of an abrogation of manners this was. And it's the sort of thing where, you know, it's the arrogance of a bunch of young whippersnappers who think that they can shoot video first and ask questions later, or scan first and ask questions later.
Let's go back to the phone lines, if we can right now, Siva, to get our next caller who's been waiting patiently. Line one, Champaign County, you're on the air with Siva Vaidyanathan, author of The Googleization of Everything.
Hi. I don't know if you've looked into this directly, but it has to do with your suspicion of a corporation that's going to organize information and bring it to us. But the kind of we have in this country another phenomena with data mining and all that, and that's the national intelligence state, which is highly privatized. I mean, SAIC, which has presence on this campus, it gets, last time I checked, $9 billion in contracts, and a lot of what they do is Google-like. So I'm wondering, is everybody okay there? I'm wondering if you, in a cursory Google search, one can't really find out much criticism of of deals, I guess they're sub rosa, that Google would have in sharing intelligence with, and maybe it's sharing data with not just the NSA, but the private corporations that are involved in the same sort of thing. And I have the same sort of reaction to your idea that, you know, why is a corporation going to take on the mantle of being the organizer of intelligence, but why, when we have corporations that are bottom line, you know, driven, doing and with no oversight to speak of, less oversight than the regular intelligence department. So I don't know if that's anything that you can actually address. If not, I'll leave it hanging in the air, and maybe another show will address that.
I'll tell you what, that, you know, if I had the chops to write that book, I would have done it, because that's a much bigger story and a much, I think, more crucial story to our lives, the extent to which the national surveillance state has joined with private actors and basically left us at their mercy. I'm happy to report that there's no evidence that Google is part of that problem. So, I mean, it's not at all. Google has, to my knowledge, never behaved like the telecom companies did in 2003 and 4, when the Bush administration basically said, hey, you need to let us tap into your systems and listen to people talking on the phone in clear violation of U.S. law, right? That happened, and we just sort of, you know, ran past it. There were a few hearings and a New York Times article that appeared conveniently after the 2004 election. And, you know, that was should have been one of the greatest scandals of our lives, but Congress quickly went and insulated these companies from liability. And, you know, that's a shame in itself. People have written books about that, and I've read them, and they make me angry. But, that's not the sort of stuff that I was prepared to handle. Fortunately, as I said, Google doesn't seem to be part of that in any way, and I actually give them a lot of credit for, at some very important times, standing up for their reputation with their users. And, of course, again, it's in their self-interest to do that, to be trustworthy to us. But they have, on a number of occasions, stood up to the Justice Department in its efforts to gather user information in bulk. The Justice Department, for instance, was trying to figure out the sorts of things that we Americans search for as a way of defending an anti-pornography statute that was being challenged in court. And Google said, no, we don't want to give the Justice Department blanket access to the record of American search terms. First of all, it would be kind of silly because, oh my gosh, Americans like pornography. Surprise, surprise. But secondly, you know, there's just too much data mapping and data mining you could do with that kind of collection that would have nothing to do with the case. And they fought it. Unfortunately, they lost. Whereas, you know, other search companies had much more easily given the government access to that information with a simple subpoena. The real danger here is not that Google would be actively complicit, but that it and any other company could be passively complicit. Because the situation we have now in this country is that, armed with a national security letter, not even a warrant, not even a subpoena, federal law enforcement can walk into a company like Google and say, you know, I want Siva Vaidyanathan's records. And Google doesn't save that much about us after 90 days, but it saves all of our Gmail, right, if we use Gmail. But in terms of search habits, it is a limited but potentially very useful collection of information. And so as a result, any company that collects this stuff can be passively complicit in some great injustice.
Well, Siva, at that point, let's go back to our phone lines because we have a couple of callers waiting patiently. I want to make sure we have a chance to get to them. Our guest today, Siva Vaidyanathan, the author of the new book, The Googleization of Everything. Let's now go to line 2, Slaterville Springs, New York. You're on the air.
Thanks for another wonderful show, Bob. And I want to bring together a couple threads that were just discussed. One of the things that you guys were just talking about was the Google Books project and other projects along the same lines. And Evan Moglen, who was the former lead counsel for the Free Software Foundation, likes to say that free software is the largest body of freely available knowledge on the planet. And that's, you know, the way they've done things has made everything available over time. And along that thread, without the free software and the GNU Linux operating system, Google wouldn't even exist.
Right.
So so Google Books is and these similar projects, including a group called the Amateur Scanning League, is really working hard to put all kinds of knowledge available for everybody. At the same time, the free software movement is working very hard for, you know, freedom, which is what free in the free software stands for, and privacy as well. So I think that, you know, these kinds of issues really all go together, and I wondered if Siva had any comments on these ideas.
Well, that's a really important insight, and I do wish I had done more with the story you just told. The extent to which, I mean, I've already pointed out the extent to which Google owes its founding to the public and public funding, but it's just as importantly, Google owes its approach and much of its success to the free software or open source software movements that have been so central to the liberation of voices around the world over the past 20 years. The free software movement starts from an ethical position that software is a set of tools that people should use to help each other, and that we shouldn't use copyright to limit the access to it, to create scarcity. We can instead use copyright in a peculiar way, in a particular way, to lock it open. And this runs directly counter to the ideology of, say, Microsoft. Now, in the early days, you know, Google was all about taking this ethic and the ethic of the web, the fact that the web is all about a set of egalitarian practices that you and I engage in when we create web pages, that we link to pages, often, more often than not, pages we like, occasionally pages we hate. And this act of linking, of taking someone's attention, saying, you don't have to pay attention to me anymore, I'm going to take you somewhere else, was something that the insight of Google's founders was basically, this is a vote of affirmation, and pages that receive a large number of these links mean something in the web and therefore have potentially more relevance or importance than other pages to which no one links. And in addition, as you said, the infrastructure of Google, the way their servers run, the software they use in-house is, if not explicitly free or open source, then modeled on in certain cases. The software Google creates, of course, has to be protected by trade secrets. A lot of it has to be proprietary, but not all of it, right? And so Google has tried to keep enough of their projects amendable in the open, not to use too technical terms. But, you know, for instance, Google Maps, you're able to use Google Maps to hack together your own useful maps of, you know, clean bathrooms in Manhattan, or as I've used in the past, the maps that people have made of baby changing stations in Manhattan, you know, those sorts of things, empowering users to do their own thing with Google's work is an extension of the ethic of the free and open source software movements. Google can't be completely, you know, hippie free and open source because, of course, it has to make money, but it's figured out a really brilliant way to unify the proprietary world and the free and open source world, and that's one of the keys to its brilliance and success. One of the reasons that it feels a lot less coercive, and I frankly is a lot less coercive than companies like Microsoft.
Let's go back to the phone lines for our final caller of the day to line 3, Champagne. You're on the air with Siva Vaidyanathan.
Yes. Hello. How accurate can this information that they're gathering be? There's always been that saying, garbage in, garbage out. An example is I was interested in the ecology of the droppings of the sloth in the jungles, and I typed in to Google sloth poop. And I swear that over on the right, it said Target has sloth poop at low prices and stuff. So now, can we download this and find out what they've got on us? And could we sue them for defamation of character? Because I do not want to be associated with sloth poop.
Wow. I hadn't thought about that, that particular case study. Yeah, no, you probably could not sue them for defamation of character, largely because no one beyond Google and no human beings have easy access to your records that Google. And as I said, Google keeps a record of your searches for a very short period of time, and then it essentially anonymizes it. But the question of how anonymized it is up for grabs. But what Google does have, if you use Gmail or if you have a YouTube account or you use Blogger software through Google, Google has a lot more of that sort of content that you've created from your own activities. That you know, but you're essentially in control of everything you write in email. What the real challenge here is whether a third party, the government of the People's Republic of China, has, we know, hacked into Gmail and is now messing with Gmail in some other ways and really endangering the lives of dissidents, people who are fighting for democracy or religious freedom in China. And that's the real danger here. I don't think that there's a necessary hazard in the details that Google knows about you. Google knows enough about you to be able to target ads as well as it can under most circumstances. And while sometimes they seem to miss and it gets kind of weird, and as you, this example points out, you know, overall, I don't think there's a measurable harm to that. I mean, I think that the comical ad placement occurs much more often on Facebook, though, which is one of the reasons that Facebook has only now just begun to make money.
See, we only have a few minutes left, and there's one question I definitely want to get to. This week, AT&T announced that it would try to be purchasing T-Mobile for $39 billion. Creating effectively what would be a duopoly in broadband internet access, which is clearly the booming area now of the internet. And traditionally, Google has been a proponent of network neutrality, meaning that the ISPs, broadband ISPs, could not discriminate against websites, internet users, had to treat them all equally. And as we're moving to this new wireless world, we're dominated by AT&T on one hand and Verizon on the other hand, which is not covered especially by net neutrality by the most recent rules, or will not be. It's more of a privatized world closer to cable TV. How does Google evolve? Are they going to team up with one of these giants and just sort of go into this sort of not fully open World Wide Web to this new world order? How is this going to play out in your mind?
So a couple of years ago, when I really started the heavy research of that in this book, and I had, and in my book proposal, I said, look, here are the following areas in which Google has a very strong invested interest that happens to coincide with the public interest. I never go as far as saying Google's working for the public interest. And those two areas were, number one, competition in the mobile space, especially real competition for the spectrum that was being auctioned by the FCC. And secondly, that Google is committed to network neutrality, because basically, the more time you spend on the open web and the more creative stuff people can do on the web, the better it is for Google. Google's the master of the open web. It runs the open web. It's Caesar of the web. And the more time you spend in the open web as opposed to Facebook or on your iPhone, the more money Google makes and the better we all are off, I think. So those were two things I was going to say. That, you know, we have to understand that Google has a self-interest in those two things as it was planning to move into the business of creating mobile phone operating systems. What happened was there was a moment when Google was a really effective player in the bidder, in fact, for some of the spectrum that the FCC was auctioning off. Google was trying to open up the mobile world so that it could force the FCC to adopt rules that would limit what cell phone carriers could do to exclude software, right? So maybe the iPhone could never, Steve Jobs could never order Google products off of the iPhone. They wanted to get that kind of rule in there that would really make sure they were never locked out. But secondly, they wanted us to have a much more competitive environment in mobile service, knowing that over time, more and more of us are going to do more of these activities through our pocket devices rather than our desktop devices. And they were really worried that if they don't keep these mobile environments...
Steve, can you wrap this in about 15 seconds? Unfortunately,
sure.
The band's tuning up in the background.
But what happened was, they ended up succeeding too much with their mobile phone stuff, with their mobile phones, and now they've cut deals with these telecom companies and given up network neutrality in the mobile space. So they've sold us out. They never sold themselves out. Their interest just changed, and it's a sad coda to the story.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to, has joined us for the full hour, has been Siva Vaidyanathan, the author of the new book, The Googleization of Everything. Siva, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Krohoff for working the board, Melissa Trentz, my producer, as always, for her great work. We'll be back, everyone, in 167 hours. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Sunny for today, the high 38 with northeast winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour. Partly cloudy tonight, down to 25, still the same northeast winds at 10 to 15. Mostly sunny for tomorrow, Monday's high 43, partly cloudy and 28 Monday night, then clouds on Tuesday with a chance of light rain or light snow moving in the afternoon, and a high of around Urbana. From PR.